Hello, I'm Jason DeRosso, and welcome to The Final Cut. Today on the show, I'm speaking to Brazilian filmmaker Claibo Mendonça Filho about the film that the Brazilian government didn't want the Oscars to see. I'll also tell you about the new movie that attempts to draw a line under the Wolverine franchise. It's called Logan, and I'll be talking about an adaptation of the best-selling Australian novel Jasper Jones. But before all that, I'm joined in the studio by a special guest, the subject of a new documentary titled A Cinematic Life. He's a man who for more than two decades was this country's preeminent broadcast film critic alongside his TV co-host, Margaret Pomerantz. He was also the artistic director of the Sydney Film Festival and critic for the trade paper Variety, as well as the Australian newspaper. It is, of course, David Stratton. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jason. Good to be here.
Is it good to be back in the building?
Yes, it is. I feel slightly alien. I used to have my pass that opened every door, and now I have to...
I had to swipe you in this time.
Yeah, that's right.
It's quite different.
It is.
I have to ask you this week, did you watch the Oscars?
I was on a plane from Perth to Brisbane. It's the first time in as long as I can remember that I didn't see the Oscars.
Yeah. Well, you certainly had some news when you disembarked from the plane.
I did, yes.
Because I guess my question to you, being such an experienced critic, what do you think of the way that the awards season has become such a thing and it's so concentrated now? I mean, it didn't used to be like that.
And there are so many awards too. I mean, you know, even Australia's got in with its international awards. I know, it's become bigger and bigger and bigger. It seems like more people are watching award shows than watching the actual movies sometimes.
Oh, absolutely. And they're all these awards are in line to kind of ramp up to this big PR event. I mean, do you think Hollywood PR, the muscle of that, is stronger than ever before?
I think it's pretty strong. But having said that, most of the films up for Best Film were independent American films.
Yeah.
And it was a pretty good lineup this year, wasn't it, really?
Well, there were smaller films, which was nice to see. And Moonlight, of course, Best Picture, a small film by American
very
standards.
Small, very small film, yeah.
Look, let's talk about this film, this fascinating documentary about your life, about your love of cinema and your love of Australian cinema as well. There's a portion of this film where you talk about your ASIOfile.
Mm.
At the time when you were director of the Sydney Film Festival, and this was a file kept on your activities when you were sort of going to the Soviet embassy and sort of getting in contact with Eastern Bloc filmmakers and distributors and so forth. It struck me, I was trying to think, is there an equivalent now? Is there a place where you could source films from now that would be just as dangerous and sort of just as exhilarating for a film programmer?
I suppose Iran might get the interest of ASIO. I don't know. I mean, it was an absurd situation when I discovered very late in the day, years later, that my phone was being tapped sometimes. And we even discovered that information was being given to ASIO, judging by the file, which I got access to, that meant that one of the board members of the festival may well have been an ASIO
plant. Spy.
Mm-hmm. Reporting. Now, it's because, of course, the Sydney Film Festival was showing international films, and that included films from the Eastern Bloc. It didn't matter that we were showing them from the Western Bloc as well. But it also, to me, kind of, when I discovered it, it sort of emphasized the fact that there's a sort of a suspicion of the arts. The arts are kind of a bit left-wing.
Mm.
You know what I mean? I mean, it's an absolutely ridiculous suspicion, but that's what it seems that people in authority in those days, and maybe still today, thought about the arts.
There is a very strong theme running through this documentary about your life, the theme of family. And I didn't realise to what degree, I mean, your brother's in this film, I didn't realise to what degree your family kind of didn't understand your love of cinema, your family back in England. And, of course, it's a cliche, but it's very real in your life that you sort of found a kind of surrogate family both on screen and in the film industry in this country as well.
Yep. Yes, that's absolutely true. But it's also something that the director, Sally Aitken, has brought out of this material, and I think she's done a beautiful job finding links that I was completely unaware of in my own story and with the Australian, some of the Australian films that I like so much. For example, the scene in Careful He Might Hear You where the boy who hasn't seen his father for a long time and the father played by John Hargreaves comes and there's a very stiff greeting and then he gives him a totally useless gift. Now, that happened to me. My father was away at the war. He came home finally. We didn't know each other at all. I was 6 years old, and he gave me a totally useless gift, and I didn't know, and I rejected it, which was a terrible thing to do. I mean, looking at it from his point of view now, it breaks my heart.
And you weren't really aware that there was that parallel, as you know, that was something that
never
Sally
occurred
Aitken,
to me.
Isn't that interesting?
Never occurred to me.
So for you watching this film back, or at least watching, I assume you're watching some of the earlier edits. Must have been quite a confronting experience.
I didn't watch early edits. No, I didn't have anything much at all to do with the post production of the film because I just didn't have time. I mean, I was. I'd have had to have been in the editing room every day, as Sally was, with Adrian Rosterolla, the editor, who did a brilliant job, I think. So I saw the rough cut of Cinematic Life. Just a few days before Christmas, the day that I recorded the narration for it.
Tell me about the moment that you break down in this film. Mm. I mean, it's a very powerful moment. And I think given that your on-screen presence, as most Australians know you in the two movie shows that you co-hosted with Margaret Pomerantz on SBS and ABC, given that that on-screen presence was always, you were always the straight man.
Yes.
It was quite surprising to me to see this emotion, and it just sort of, it seemed to surprise you even. And you're talking about your mother at this point.
Yeah, well, it was my parents were very disapproving, really, of first of all, as a child, when I wanted to spend all my time at the cinema, my parents made it very clear that they thought it was a complete waste of time. And they got very exasperated with me. And I must say, I went to some shameful lengths to deceive them sometimes by telling them I was going to do something. And then, of course, I was going to the cinema. And then when I decided to stay in Australia to run the Sydney Film Festival rather than return to England and join my father in the family business, which was a long-established business founded in the 1820s, and it was what my father always wanted me to do and expected me to do, and I had expected to do it. But I didn't. I stayed here, and my father was, as you see in the film, and my brother explains, my father was terribly, terribly upset. What you don't see in the film, which made it even worse, was that about 3 or 4 years after I made that decision to stay in Australia, my father was taken ill, and he had to retire from business. And my brother was too young to take over the business, and so the business was sold. And my father, I think, blamed me for that, that a family tradition going back sort of three or four generations, had come to an end because of me. You know, that's quite a guilt trip to shoulder. But it made it worse because I don't think they ever knew what I was really doing. I don't think they, because they didn't care anything about films themselves, they didn't know that there was anything of value that I was doing to make up for my betrayal, if you like. So that incident that you're talking about was actually the last time I saw my mother, and they'd come down to the Cannes Film Festival on the last day of the festival, and we went out to dinner and up in the hills above Cannes, and there was this couple I could see at another table looking at me, and as they got up to leave, the woman just came to me and said, "You know, we're from Melbourne, I think, and we just love your work. Thank you so much."
Yeah,
and my mother was very quick to say, "He's my son," and I think that was the first time they realised that I was doing something worth doing.
Your time as a critic really coincided with a great time in Australian film, and you talk about some great films, some very important films, Wake and Fright. It's interesting, though, also that you talk about films that you didn't like, And some films that you changed your mind on as well, like The Castle, for example. Is it important for a critic to be able to change their mind? I think Russell Crowe in the film talks about how this is an element of your character that he admires the most.
Yes, look, I think it is important not to be too hidebound. After all, it's only one person's opinion, isn't it? I mean, you know this, Jason, yourself. You're paid a modest stipend to every week give your opinion, your very valued opinion, on the films that you review. And people come to listen to you every week and they know where your taste lies so they can know whether they're going to share your view or not after listening to you for a while. And it was the same, obviously, with us on the show. But when it came to The Castle, I think because comedy is so nationally specific and The Castle is such an Australian film, and I guess I still, despite all the years I've lived in this country, I still have maybe a British sense of humour. I guess it's fair to say I didn't get it. And I also marked it down because I think I used the word aesthetically, but what I meant was cinematically. It's a fairly ordinary film. It doesn't sort of go anywhere very special cinematically. So I was very mean to The Castle, it seems to me now. But then people started saying, oh, you've really missed out on something. You know, it was such a shame you didn't get it. So I thought, okay, I must revisit this. So I've seen it now several times and I warm to it enormously.
Yes, well, I think Margaret Pomerantz's presence in this film is one of the sort of invaluable elements of it too, I think. She sort of rives you a little bit in it. And I think you're pictured in a restaurant overlooking Sydney Harbour, which is quite nice. You're eating oysters, I think.
Margaret's eating oysters.
I like that element of it. Do you think that when you think about your time together on screen and certainly your time as a critic working for the papers as well, do you lament the sort of standard or the output of Australian films since that golden age, and especially since that sort of generation of sort of Peter Weirs and Bruce Beresfords and so forth? Do you think we've yet to really follow up on their promise?
I think there's some truth in that. I mean, we went through that incredible period in the second half of the 70s and up into the beginning of the 80s when there were so many films that were not only very good, but they were successful here and abroad. But at the same time, I think it's interesting that today there are some very good Australian films that really fail to find an Australian audience. And
what's an example?
Well, The Babadook, for example. I mean, The Babadook, which is an excellent, really excellent horror film, and it did pretty well overseas.
Yes,
but it completely failed to find an audience here in the cinema, anyway. And I just wonder why young people who support horror films more than the older generation, it seems, why they didn't support that film. I remember the week it opened, there was a Hollywood horror film, very inferior. And which one do you think audiences flocked to see? I mean, it's that Hollywood publicity machine that draws people seemingly without thinking into a mediocre film when they could have had something really outstanding like The Babadook.
Well, we began our discussion on Hollywood and we've ended there, but certainly in the middle there was so much more, and certainly what's evident in this very insightful documentary about your life is how much you did try and seek out the good stuff within Hollywood and beyond its borders as well. It's been a pleasure having you on the show, David Stratton.
Jason, it's been a pleasure for me too.
Legendary Australian film critic, cinephile, film scholar and programmer David Stratton. And the documentary, A Cinematic Life, is in limited release around the country from next week. But this week, you may just be lucky enough to catch one of the Q&A screenings that are travelling around the country. I'm Jason DeRosso on Twitter at JDRRR. If you're listening as a podcast and you've got a moment, do leave a rating or even a review of the show. It is, of course, RN's weekly film programme, The Final Cut. Next up, we're going to Brazil.
Hoje trago em meu corpo as marcas do meu tempo, meu desespero, a vida num momento, a fossa, a fome, a flor, o fim do mundo. Hoje.
When nominations were announced for the Best Foreign Language Oscar, for many critics, including myself, around the world, one film that was conspicuous by its absence was Aquarius, a thriller about shady dealings in the world of beachside real estate set in Recife in Brazil. It stars the beautiful Sonia Braga as a woman facing down unscrupulous property developers. And it's the second film from writer-director Kleber Mendonça Filho. His first film, Neighbouring Sounds, was about similar themes, but it sprawled across many characters. It was about a single street dominated by a wealthy family, and its interrogation of class, race, and geography unfolded in straight drama with some sophisticated detours into surrealism and symbolism. Imagine Francesco Rosi's classic 1963 film about the mafia and Naples property developers' hands over the city, crossed with some kind of tropical hallucination. Well, this superb follow-up, Aquarius, which was not chosen by the Brazilian government as its entry into the Oscars, has a title inspired by an elegant beachside apartment block in the film that comes under the shadow of the wrecking ball. Similar themes to Neighbouring Sounds are concentrated into a much more personal story, though, of Braga's character, a renowned writer and public intellectual in her 60s, who lives in this apartment alone and is the last occupant left, refusing to sell. The film sprawls across time via flashbacks and across the physical space of the city, from its ghettos to its fine dining restaurants from the beach to the interior domestic space, sometimes in a single sensuous long take. As a former critic and cinephile, the director and writer Mendonça Filho's eye is both lyrical and very refined, but his film is structured to operate like a funnel, channeling the tensions into something intense and irrepressible. And very much in the thriller genre, this is a film that gains momentum in a series of escalations until finally you arrive at a heart-pounding climax. What Aquarius says about the corruption of Brazilian society is certainly a confronting indictment. But it was when Mendonça Filho and his cast walked the red carpet at the Cannes Film Festival last year that the film raised the ire of the Brazilian government. The festival happened during the impeachment process of then-President Dilma Rousseff. And when the director and his actors held up signs for the paparazzi on the red carpet, written in Portuguese, English, and French, with messages like, "Brazil is not a democracy anymore," well, needless to say, the film won no friends in the incoming government. The Sydney Film Festival awarded Aquarius its prize last year for audacious filmmaking, and the film also featured in many top 10 lists of 2016, including my own. It was not chosen by the Brazilian Culture Ministry as Brazil's official Oscar entry. If it had been, I dare say it might have won. This interview with Mendonça Filho was recorded a month after he walked the red carpet at Cannes, but before that Oscar's decision in June in Sydney.
I always saw the film as a siege movie. The perimeter area of where she lives is very well established right from the beginning. She has this apartment, it's in a building, and basically what happens throughout the film is that there are people trying to come in, which is a classic situation. I mean, if you think of, you know, Fort Apache and, you know, American Westerns or John Carpenter's Assault on Precinct 13. Of course, those are more extreme situations where people have weapons outside and people are trying to defend themselves inside. There are no weapons in Aquarius, but the threat of invasion, the idea of something being, of security being compromised, is always present in the film, and it seems to work.
I'm thinking also of the way formally there's a wonderful zoom that takes us from a couple essentially, I was going to say making love, but they're not making love, they're screwing on the beach. Yeah. I mean, it's quite a grotesque sort of a couple of legs in the air, you know. And then we see a couple of other people on the beach, and then suddenly we're back into the apartment, and there she is trying to sleep on, we've got a close-up of her face, I think, and she's trying to sleep on the hammock. Mm-hmm. Shots like that where you don't cut to divide outside and inside, was that part of the ploy to sort of suggest, look, the outside is very ever-present with
the
inside?
Oh, yeah. I mean, a shot like that is, which took maybe 5 hours to shoot because we did it 16 times. because it's a combination of different things. You know, you have the couple, and then you have the zoom lenses and the way the camera pans to the left, and then how it the zoom brings the frame back into the apartment, and it was very complicated to do, but I think it pays off because it's all about space. I'm fascinated by how, I mean, in our houses, the places where we live, we're inside, and then there is the outside, and the windows, they allow, you know, exterior life to come into your house. It could be through sound. But I love the way you also contribute to sounds from your own place, which when sounds spill over to the street, you know, and I find that relationship fascinating. And when you put it in the film as a narrative device, it tends to give a real feeling of space. And I really liked your question because you got it. I mean, that's exactly what it is. It's a feeling of space in one shot.
Writer-director Kleiber Mendonça-Filho and his stunning thriller Aquarius is showing at Cinema Nova in Melbourne with other states to follow. Keep a lookout for it on VOD soon too. If both films I've talked about so far on the show don't really attract you, the chances are you may be interested in either the new Wolverine movie, Logan, or the coming-of-age drama Jasper Jones from Australian director Rachel Perkins. In the minutes I have left, I'll give you my brief opinion on both.
In the real world, people die.
Logan.
I don't want to talk about it.
Logan.
Just stop.
Be careful. I need the girl.
What girl?
Go get her.
Logan is a film that brings to a close a trilogy about Hugh Jackman's Wolverine, a character from the X-Men series who sprouts metal blades from his fists when he's angry and also has superhuman powers of regeneration. But these powers are failing him when he drags himself onto the screen in this film. He's tired and sick. He has a very frail wheelchair-bound Professor X, played by Patrick Stewart, in tow, and a young Mexican girl, Daphne Keene, orphaned early in the film, who's also by his side. Together, they're on the road and on the run from dark forces within the American government. You know the score. Director James Mangold's follow-up to Wolverine is an ominous, discordant film of surrogate familial tensions. The shootouts and the car chases are very stylish, but it's this recurring theme of anger management issues that point to some kind of third act transcendence. This never arrives. Logan hovers in a zone of eternal promise, a great first act, a great second act, but an underwhelming third act that resorts to some formulaic baton passing in its final scenes, presumably for future X-Men iterations. Logan is worth a look, but for me, disappointing.
Charlie, it's Jasper.
Who?
Jasper Jones.
What are you doing here?
I need your help.
Me? Why me?
Come with me. I'll show you.
Jasper Jones, based on the novel of the same name, has the ingredients of a classic. Early on, a young white kid in mid-60s small-town Australia gets a knock on the bedroom window at night. A black friend, Jasper Jones, has come to take him into a nearby forest where he's found the body of a local girl. The three elements of this sequence, a white child, a black child, and an unexplained death, evocatively directed with a soaring crane shot over dense bushland by Rachel Perkins, contain everything you need for a coming-of-age story that also says something deeper about a nation coming to terms with its own hidden crimes. And yet, Jasper Jones is not the film that this setup promises. Instead, it trips over several different storylines. There are the parents on the cusp of divorce, the Vietnamese family copping bricks through the window from racists, the grumpy hermit, played by Hugo Weaving, on the edge of town with a thorn in his paw that will need pulling. As a story, it recalls To Kill a Mockingbird, but the film might have been better reimagining itself as a much more slender affair, maybe in the style of a Stephen King parable. As it stands, Jasper Jones plods along, and it doesn't do great justice to the enigmatic figure of Jasper Jones, the character. He hovers around the outskirts of this town and the outskirts of the story, deliberately so, but when he's brought into the centre, he's never quite as evocatively portrayed as he is in that early scene by the bedroom window, which seems like a missed opportunity. Jasper Jones ultimately feels a little misshapen. I'm Jason DeRosso. You've been listening to RN's weekly film show, The Final Cut. See you next week.
This Is About is a podcast hosted by Jordan Raskopoulos. That's me. Stories told by those who live them.
To do a good job, you kind of have to believe that you're Spider-Man.
He was holding what he claimed was Ned Kelly's skull.
She just said to me, if you can't have this baby, I'll have a baby for you.
What I thought was two different dolphins was just one shark.
What?
This Is About on the ABC Radio app or wherever you get your favourite podcasts.
Listen now.
On your phone.
You know, just do the thumb thing.